thanks for jumping on again. This is good timing, I think. You know, we've got a new single out. And it's another little barn burner of a tight, great little pop song.
Thank you. Yeah, we're excited about it, and it's exciting to just put out something new. It's been a couple of years. It doesn't feel like it, and it never does, because, you know, first of all, time flies, and second of all, when you're trying to support an album, you know, it's just a one day, one step at a time type of thing, and trying to book shows and trying to get people to hear it and trying to all that stuff. So 2 years feels like, you know, 6-8 months. And we're working on various different you know, plenty of new material, of course, and thinking about an album, but both of us were like, well, we should really just, let's just put out a single, because that's what the kids are doing anyway. And it's just feels like it's a good time to do it. And the song that was sort of the furthest down the road, as it were, was this song, Swing and a Miss. And actually, you know, looking at the calendar, I was like, you know what, putting it out when baseball starts would actually be kind of perfect. We have plenty of time to go through the whole release process of the Spotify and the band camps and all the different things you have to do. And so that's what ended up being the case. And so, yeah, we're excited. You know, it's been out for just a few days, and we have gotten one spin on the radio so far.
Nice.
Out in Richmond, Virginia. So that's cool. You know, you never really expect that in the first couple of days of putting something out. Well, Taylor Swift does, but we don't. So it's just nice to be making forward progress. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because obviously growing up in England, baseball's just not a thing. But in my opinion, The Sandlot is the greatest sports movie of all time. So there's a real nostalgia to this song that I found that it was easy for me to get into, even though it's not my experience, that I know what this song's about. It's about that sort of, you know, the underdog, and it's about keep getting up and dusting yourself off. So that kind of, you know, the childhood summer thing still kind of comes through in this song for me.
Right. Well, there you go. And if I'm not mistaken, you do still swing in cricket, right?
You like, absolutely do.
So, hey, it could just be that. Yeah, it's funny. You know, I work at a summer camp as a music director for many years. And so we used to, this is out in Milwaukee, we used to go to a Milwaukee Brewers game every summer, and they stopped doing it because, yes, the American staff and the kids to some degree were always excited about it and looking forward to it. But there's so many staff from England, from South Africa, from Russia, places like this, where they're just like, you know, we don't know what this is. And so they would just go and, you know, eat at the TGI Fridays in the stadium. And some of them really did take a certain fascination to it and try and learn what was going on. But yeah, not as popular, certainly, among the non-American crowd from those places. Obviously, Latin America and Japan and all that. More enthusiasm, certainly.
But I was not really into football very much, and this Canadian football is different again to the NFL type brand, because we get an extra player up here. We play with 12, right? But when you go to a stadium and watch a game, I think if you like sport at all, you just sort of get caught up in it. But I think that, you know, baseball is one of those words that is just very, it's American. Like, it just sort of, it's one of those things that defines America. Right. It's just kind of throughout the country, it's been for years and years. Well, probably over 100 years now, right? I think leagues in different varieties have been going on. So it's just part of the very foundation, sort of DNA of the country, which is, I don't know that soccer is in the same way in England, because soccer is more global. We don't really have that one thing. Maybe cricket. But again, that's played in the colonies and everything else. So I think baseball is that uniquely American pastime, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And I was actually surprised when I went, years ago, I went to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And interestingly, all the statistics that they show and the lists of who holds the records for what and such like that, the international leagues are not in their own room. Like, it's right there.
Right.
If it's talking home runs, you'll see Hank Aaron. Yeah. And then whoever's the leader in Japan, you know, in those leagues, they're right there on the same chart. They're not separated out, which I found interesting, you know, that they, you know, at the Hall of Fame, it's all, they consider it one enchilada. But yeah, it is uniquely American, and it's something that, you know, I mean, I was obsessed as a kid, we've been doing all this social media stuff with, you know, where I busted out all my old baseball cards and I've been taking pictures of the different pages of players that I really loved and that sort of thing. So, I mean, once I got into high school, you know, basically, I mean, the amount that I paid attention to baseball dropped precipitously right around the time I started playing in a band. Coincidence? Yeah. Probably not. And Mika too, she, you know, was she followed baseball for quite a while. Neither of us are, you know, necessarily watch on the regular anymore, but you're right, there is a certain amount of baked in DNA,
yeah,
to the sport and to, yeah, the American experience. And and, you know, for convenience's sake, we, our band and our music, we have filed under Americana, because that is a genre, that is a radio, that's an official radio genre, and we needed one, and that one seemed to be the closest match. So I suppose a song about baseball is not going to be a bad thing when it comes to matching our so-called genre.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we should say to people too that this isn't a song about baseball. You know, it's sort of, you're using those central metaphors and some of the terminology and that kind of thing, but it's to wrap around this universalism. And what I like about it is it's easy to be heavy-handed with that stuff, right? But in this song, when you lean into, you know, the foul ball and all that kind of stuff, it feels organic and it feels natural. So I had a question for you. What came first on this one? Because I think I remember you saying that you tend to write music first. But I was curious about whether the lyrical idea for this came first, or whether you had a, you know, the sort of the progression and the chord structures and the, you know, the sort of the template for it, and then found the words later.
Yeah, the title came first because I play in a band. I play guitar in a band called Dry September. It's a roots rock type of band, and they have a song where I always heard the lyric "swing and a miss" in the song, and I thought, oh, that, you know, that's a cool lyric. And then at one point we were doing, I forget if we were recording it or whatever it was, just like when you go to karaoke, there was a time when it was the first time I saw the lyrics in front of my face, and that's not what the lyric was. It was swinging in pairs.
Right.
I'm like, dude, what the, I've been misunderstanding your lyric for so long, and it's such a cool, so I was like, that's it, I'm going to have to write a song called Swing and a Miss now. So I did, and as I recall, and this was a while ago, this is one of those songs that kind of sat in the catalog back burner for a bit. So I remember writing it rather quickly and recording a demo of it, and then that was it. You know, a lot of times you record a demo and then you just don't do anything with it. You know, if it's not your band, or if it's not something that sounds like what you're doing at that time, then you just kind of file it away, and you don't tend to forget about the things you have filed away. And when it's time for them to come out, they come out. But yeah, I think it's something I wrote just quite quickly around the, but the consequence of writing something quickly and then setting it aside, the lyrics weren't done. I mean, they were done in that I sang it from front to back, but there was a lot of placeholder stuff. So I did probably 50% of them I rewrote
yeah,
you know, just a few months ago. And I was worried about, once I was done, I'm like, I think that people might think this is actually sung to a baseball player. So I sent it to a trusted friend and I said, hey, I'm going to play you this song and I'm not going to tell you, I have a question for you, but I'm not going to tell you what it is until after you've listened a couple times. So he did that. And then I said, does it sound like I'm singing to a baseball player? And he said, definitely not. That never crossed my mind for a second. Yeah. So, okay, good. And then I think I can say I'm done rewriting now.
But like I said, you know, it superficially, the first time I listened, like, oh, like I said, it's breezy, it clips along, it's really, really nice. But of course, because you're so experienced and you're such a good sort of studio craftsman, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in here that you don't notice necessarily if you are just listening to it. I call it, you know, actively versus recreational. If you just listen to it recreational and let it wash over you, you're going to miss that you change and you move to the E instead of the G. Or when you're coming out of the pre-chorus, there's little things in there that as a musician, you think, ah, that's nice. That's a really nice little switch.
Yeah, it's nice to have just little, exactly, that's exactly right. Just having a change up or two, no pun intended, that catches the ear, and that will catch the ear of anybody, but some might know why it caught their ear and others might not know why. And clearly, you know why. Yeah, you know, little stuff. Because, first of all, it keeps yourself engaged as a writer. And second of all, yeah, people do notice that kind of thing. And then sonically on this one, you know, I wanted it to have a fun sort of feel to it. So there is, you know, for half the song, maybe the snare drum is a combination of, yes, a snare, but also the crack of a bat, you know, sound effect that I
Yeah.
dropped in there. You can hear it clearly at first, but then it is layered into the sound of the snare drum throughout. And yeah, for the acoustic guitars, I went with what they call a Nashville tuning. Basically, it's when like the first four strings are, no, the first two strings are the same, and then the next four are an octave up, just to give it a different sort of sound, you know, like the a brighter sound to it. And that sort of thing makes room for cello better too. Anything you can do sonically to create the space where the cello takes up just as much room as the vocal,
Yeah,
it's a good thing.
when because I'd noticed that on the snare. I was like, I can't. Is that a sample or is that what is that? And so I used this app called Fader that'll
Yeah.
create stems, right? So it doesn't do it perfectly. It was like
Right.
there's definitely something else in there, and I don't know. That's super cool that that's a little sample of a baseball or a
I
bat.
mean, definitely thought about like, you know, gathering people up and going to the park and tossing them and then miking it up, and then
Yeah.
each one was an individual hit that a friend of ours hit. But then that started to seem like a lot of trouble for something that with very, very little return. So we didn't do that, but it would have been fun, no question.
Man, you would have ended up with like, you know, the number of percussionists credited on the song. It'd have been like Earth, Wind, and Fire or something, right? It'd have been crazy.
Yeah, exactly. That's funny. That's right. So yeah, anyway, it was, you know, it's always fun to record and mix and all of that stuff. I mean, you know, or if it wasn't, I wouldn't do it myself, obviously. But yeah, thank you. It's nice when people notice little things that go into things when you don't have to enjoy it. That's, you know, that's true. But as a listener, it's fun to notice little things and to appreciate them. And yeah, you know, so far the reception's been great. And certainly, as with many things I do, but certain songs more than others, I've gotten plenty of people who are like, reminds me of Tom Petty. Now, in this case, of course, it's not as overt, in that he didn't whisper this one in my ear in a dream. But you know, it's certainly with four chord songs like this one that feel a little roots and a little Americana, the comparison is always apt, I suppose.
Yeah, but and I mean, I was going to comment on that. You sometimes don't like to draw that line, especially because this is the Tom Petty Project podcast. I don't want to always bring it back to Petty, but I think that the parallel that I do draw is that you do have that sense of knowing how much is enough, because you could really layer this song up, right? You could go completely overboard in the chorus, but there's a lot of space in this song. And I'm just listening to "You Don't Know How It Feels" today, and that's another song that's got a lot of breathing room in it. And I think that that's where the cello does shine, right? And especially because, you know, Mika's playing, I don't know, probably three different parts at different times in this song and
Right.
adding in those octaves and things. So you've got that, but because you've left enough space in there, I can still hear all that. And as a listener, that's what I want to say, is to hear the whole thing.
Yeah, there you go. And you know, in fact, in that old demo from 10 years ago or whatever it was, I mean, I stacked up vocals like crazy. I mean, it sounded like, you know, Alabama or some country thing. And I decided, you know, actively not to do that for this version and just keep it very simple, two-part harmony at most. And yeah, there you go. That's part of the reason for sure. And I think the, you know, with anything, I think people overemphasize keep it simple, stupid, and all that stuff because there's so much. I mean, can you imagine telling Tchaikovsky or Rachmaninoff, keep it simple, man? You know,
Yeah.
what's your problem? Like, no, I don't think that's a great credo all the time. But I do think that keeping it as simple as it needs to be. It is smart.
Well, and
So
also because the next doors, you do have that cello as a signature sound that just sort of separates you from pretty much anyone else. You want to give that space to breathe. You want to showcase that because that's your lead instrument. You're not soloing on guitar. That's the cello's job, right?
yeah, that's right. And you know, right. I mean, most of the if you think about songs that feature a cello, on popular radio and rock music, and there's plenty, but then their next single, you know, listen to Wonderwall or whatever, lots of cello in there, but then whatever the single they put out after that is, that didn't have it. So, yeah. You know, I think, yeah, most bands use it as a spice, as a shade or a flavor, whereas us,
yeah.
If you listen to more than one song, yeah, you quickly realize that it is part of the fabric of the music. So.
Well, I was listening to those arrangements because I didn't realize that the cello sounded so good in those higher registers. Because cello, usually you think of those bass notes, right? That's what you've done. And that's the space it takes up in the orchestra, usually, is that bottom end. But when Mika plays that second line, you know, you get to the four bars, and then you get this, the next four bars, you get that higher end in. Sounds like a string section. You know, it's got that sort of width to it.
Totally. And it's a really aggressive sound that's not as, you know, as reedy and thin as a violin can be up in those registers. It's really, you know, Mika's played me some cello concertos by some of the great cellists, and just the aggression and the sort of the piercing nature of the upper end, but like piercing musically, but not sonically. It, you know, just clear as a bell coming at you, but it sounds rich and full. And yeah, it is cool. It's not as easy to play in those upper registers, like is true for many instruments. Not so much the guitar. With the guitar, you just sort of move your hand up there and then you're done. But cello, it becomes much more difficult, or upright bass, or this sort of thing. But also it just sort of adds to the badass nature of it when you see someone do it, because it actually does not look easy. Yeah. And it's not. So.
It's very rock and roll. You know, for a classical instrument, it does look rock and roll.
Right.
I was going to say too that, you know, the structure of this song too is another thing that I like, because it's really quick getting through it, right? Verse, pre-chorus, chorus, and you've got so eight bars, but then you get six bars, which you gotta just, I like that when you drag past sometimes, you know, because you've got and it's only two lines. And I noticed too that you, another little pettyism that you do is you do mess around with the number of syllables. So you're not sort of fitting da 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 da. Sometimes you da 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 da. So you're putting in more words than it feels like should be in there sometimes, but you're making it work. And I always think that's a really good trick.
Yeah, thank you. And that's one of the things, most of that stuff was in my rewrite. Mostly it was even syllabulation in the demo.
Yeah.
And so then you're trying to change the lyrics, and you know, and when I produce other artists, anytime someone's like trying to force lyrics in, you know, square peg, round hole, and I cringe a little bit. And so when you're producing yourself, you have to remember to cringe a little, to pretend. You have to be devil's advocate to yourself, and it's easy to forget to do that. And you have to really be sure that you're not doing what you tell other people not to do, which is to take the lyrics that you just want to say and force them in where they don't belong. But I did. I ended up enjoying the song a little bit better with the way that it ended up, where there were lines that had more syllables, because then I added more notes and it became a little bit more melodic. But I was concerned about that, but I'm glad.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm glad that it worked, according to who I consider a professional music listener, in addition to a fine musician, because, you know, most people, they just say, hey, man, nice song. Cool.
Which is good too, right? I mean, that's always a nice thing to hear.
Nothing wrong with that. But to talk to a professional listener, I like even better.
Well, we'll get into some of the lyrics too, because again, it's one of those things where, you know, the second verse you change instrumentally, like there's more in there. It adds out a little bit. So you do get a bit more thickening of that sound. But again, the lyrics, you don't tend to sit in one spot with it, and you're changing up some of the lines in the choruses, because usually, you know, or quite often the chorus is the chorus, and you sing the chorus and that's the chorus, it's the verse that you change. But I like that you play with those things too. And one of the lines I'd written down, I really like, don't throw your fists when you feel like a rock that's got no roll.
Yeah.
That's just it's such a great rock and roll line. And it's not necessarily, I don't know, there's a deep meaning to that, but it's underlying that message, underscoring that message that, yeah, don't give up, don't react, just keep plowing ahead, keep picking yourself up, dust yourself off, get back up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with many of my songs, they always say write what you know. And again, I think that's overused, and I'm not someone who follows my own lyrical advice so easily. So, you know, I don't know how much it helps me to hear myself singing these things, but, you know, I wish I had the patience and the wisdom in real life that I do when I'm just putting words down on a piece of paper. But yeah, it's, you know, at the end of the day, the lyrics just need to sound good, you know, whether you're writing about something you know or you don't know, or it's nonsense. You know, there's plenty of songs, including some of my own, that the lyrics came from nonsense. It was just some rhyme that you happened to pop in your head when you were jamming in with the band, and they stick. As for the choruses, you know, that's always a risk to have them change. I think probably those are the types of things that somebody might not be able to put their finger on, but might say if they're considering it for radio or for the playlist or something like that. That's the type of thing that might subconsciously make someone think something's less catchy when it doesn't just simply repeat the choruses. And while it's easy to say, well, that's just dumb, it is and it's not. So, you know, that's definitely a choice and one I thought about. I wonder if I should just keep all the choruses the same lyric or not. And I ended up going with not.
Again, though, I think that because it's reinforcing, right? You could just say the same thing, but it's reinforcing the idea. And you're just saying, because you're saying the same thing in the chorus.
Right.
Just finding a different way. Don't you know? Usually you're going to get up, or sorry, even the best of the best becomes even the best in the biz, you know, becomes, I don't know, different from the rest. So that movement, I don't know, I think it works perfectly.
Well, hey, I'm going to go with your statement just now, and we're going to frame it and put it on all of our social media. I think it works perfectly in quotes. Attribute you, obviously, and I'll take it. Yeah.
Well, and the switch too, because a swing and a miss, you know, the miss there is the noun, but in the chorus, when you sing it, it's swing and miss. You drop the A out, so then it becomes the verb, then it's active, right? So again, I like little, I'm a word nerd, so I love little bits of wordplay like that. So
that's true. Yeah.
Then so the other line that I really honed in on was, and you won't ever reach perfection, but now and again you'll get home all right. So Ken, obviously there's the allusion there back to home base in baseball, but I always think that it's a really good thing to tell people that not reaching perfection's fine, because really it's kind of a silly goal. To try and set perfection as your goal is kind of insane, really, because you're never going to reach perfection. But the pursuit towards improvement is what you really want, right? And like that, you'll get home all right. That's that kind of saying to me anyway. That's like, yeah, the journey is the important part and it'll be okay as long as you follow through and run, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is probably not the fodder of, you know, someone who works at the NSA or National Defense or anything like that. They're probably not like, you know, 33% is a pretty good percentage when it comes to protecting us from foreign enemies. Nope. You know, different things are different. But yes, when it comes to sports, when it comes to art, even, you know, I mean, you go to the museums that are dedicated to a specific artist, you go to the Picasso Museum, the Dali Museum, and you see all these things that you've never seen before in your life, because they're not in the most of the history books, the art history books. Only a few of them are.
Yeah.
But all of them go towards, you know, a better understanding of that artist, whether they liked it or not, whether anyone bought it or not in their lifetime, etc. So yeah, I think 33% is pretty good. That's a pretty good goal for anyone who's trying to do something creative, or you know, and I don't know, baseball's creative. I think it's cut from the same cloth. So I follow on, you know, on Instagram or whatever, I follow a few sports statistics things because they're just fun. It's just like a fun thing to break up, you know, when you just check in the morning to whatever and you're flipping through. I have The Onion, you know, because that's always just worth a laugh. And then baseball stats. I saw something on there recently that said something like Tony Gwynn could have gone 0-for-500 in his last three seasons, and he still would have finished with over a 300 batting average lifetime. Just stuff like that, where it's just like mind-blowing just how, you know, how good some of these guys are. And it's fun. It's fun to read fun statistics in anything, but especially baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big stats nerd. I'm an IT guy, right? So numbers is sort of, that's my comfort zone. I love words as well, but numbers is where I'm very, very solid.
Right.
But again, not coming from that baseball background. I remember that being a thing when I first watched a few baseball games, is like all these stats, like, wow.
Right.
You know, like, just hit the damn ball. How hard can it be? And then you think, yeah, the bats, like cricket, you've got a lot more real estate on the front of your bat, and it's kind of coming, it's coming straight towards you. And okay, it's bouncing on grass, so that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But the whip that they get on, like the change ups and the way they move that ball through the air, seems to defy physics sometimes. You think, okay, well, yeah, maybe it's a bit harder than I thought. So.
Yeah, seriously, like I get it in bowling why putting a spin on it works because it's touching a surface, but in baseball it really is something else. So have you read Moneyball?
I haven't.
Oh, you have to.
Okay.
And don't, I mean
I
the
haven't seen the
movie,
movie yet.
yeah, the movie's all well and good, but they did a, I mean what they did with the movie is brilliant. They took a book about statistics and they turned it into a something with, you know, a plot. And so, but the book itself is basically a stats book and it's something else. Yeah.
It started to, I don't say creep in a pejorative way, but it's definitely crept into soccer lately just because it's a good way of, you know, recruiting. It's a good way of, you know, if you can say that this guy tends to, on average, make, you know, 15 forward runs or 20 passes into this area, that area, if that fits your team, well,
Yeah.
then, you know, that's going to be beneficial. So there's nothing wrong with
Exactly.
stats. Stats is not a dirty word, people.
No. I think that that book did change sports to some degree. Yeah.
And of course, it's never going to change the individual, that guy being able to hit that ball
Right.
at that time. I mean, that's never going to change. You're never going to take the personality and the humanity out of sport. You know, you just can't do that, right? Because it involves humans. But speaking of humans, it involves the Mick, I
Yeah.
assume is Mickey Mantle. So
Sure.
I know that name. And then the
Yeah.
kid. So I've got the kid narrowed down to, I had to Google this one because obviously I
Yeah.
don't have that back. But so it's either Gary Carter, who
Yeah.
played for the Expos, or
Right.
Ken Griffey Jr. was the other one.
I think Robin Yount also goes by the kid, if I'm not mistaken. And
Damn
all of
it.
these guys are probably in the Hall of Fame. But no, Gary Carter, he was my favorite growing up.
Okay.
Saw him play for the Expos every once in a while. But then he got traded to the Mets. And the Mets, we actually had WOR out of New York on our basic cable back in Arizona. So, and my family's all Mets fans. They're all from
Damn it.
Brooklyn originally. So, yeah. So I always appreciated him very much on the Expos. I just didn't see that many Expos games unless they were playing the Mets or whatever. And heck, I can't even remember. Were the Expos American League or were they National League?
Jeez, now you're asking the wrong
I'm
person
not sure. So we
then.
never saw a lot of American League in our household anyway. But yeah, he just played with such heart and determination and grit. He just seemed like such a lovely human being. And so yes, that's a little nod to my favorite player from childhood.
It's nice too that his name or his nickname fits phonetically as well, you
That's
know.
right.
Very helpful on
Otherwise,
him.
yeah. Yep.
Yeah,
Totally.
the Bambino wouldn't fit in there. As good as you are at wrangling different syllables in there, I don't think that one's going to fly, right?
Exactly. Funny. Well,
Well,
thank you.
so have you played this song yet live?
Yeah, we played it for the first time when we had a gig in New York last year. And we've played it. Yeah, we played it at our last shows here in January and March. So we have, yeah, a few times now. And it, yeah, it goes over well. I mean, it's just such a catchy, melodic, you know, thing. I mean, a lot of ours are, but some of them aren't. Some, you know, more than others. And this is one that is. And of course, it's just a lyric that's easy to attach yourself to and remember. I hear songs all the time that I'm like, well, I really love that, but I can't say, you know, a week later that I remember anything about what it was about or the lyrics. But, you know, baseball, swing and a miss, it's just like, you know, catches in the brain a little bit. So, yeah, we haven't played it with like a full band yet. But when I'm sure we'll have a full band show coming up here at some point and we'll do it. But yeah, we have.
I thought I saw you played in, was that late, or the video maybe went up on YouTube late February. You're in a smaller room, but you had a backing singer and I think someone on a squeeze box, maybe. Am I misremembering that? Or
That's right.
yeah,
Yeah,
okay.
that was our Neighbor Day show here in Pasadena. And yeah, we had one song that we had a friend of ours join on accordion. That's right. And we did play Swing and a Miss. Yeah. You know, we always film shows one way or the other. Usually it's just a cell phone, one, two cell phones somewhere. And then always have the great intention of going in and editing and audio, you know, trying to just balance and EQ and whatever. Everything, and then you know, we just never find the time to do it. But every once in a while, we'll take it. We try it at least once a show, take some nugget from the show and put it out there. So, So yes, there you go. That's right.
I suppose though, I mean, when you do, because I know that a lot of stand-ups do that, especially when they're just starting, right? Because they want to see what's landing with the audience. The nice thing about watching a show is you go, yeah, everyone's tapping their foot and nodding their head. So, well, this one's going well. You know, of course, you can see that in the room at the time.
Right.
But it's still nice to have that validation. So, yeah, no, this one stays in the set then.
Yeah. Well, that exactly. And then sometimes you know, the risk of watching your shows back is that you're going to cringe, you know, from time to time. It's a palpable risk. But most of the time, well, again, you know, if as your own worst critic, if 33% of your show, you're like, yeah, that was good, then we're going to say that's that's major league territory. So usually it's, you know, somewhere in that range.
What do you mean? You mean that artists are neurotic and they tend to all be overcritical about themselves? I thought they were all like super confident, and you know, that's rock stars are confident, aren't they?
Well, again, it's one of those can you follow your own advice type of things. If a friend was like, oh man, I really think I botched that show, I would tell them you absolutely didn't. All the stuff you're talking about, nobody noticed. Everybody was having a good time. But if it's me who thinks that stuff, then obviously that advice doesn't apply. And everybody noticed the mistakes, and everybody doesn't want to go see you again. So you know how it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where can people find Swing and a Miss? Where can they find Next Doors? Send them to Bandcamp, send them to the website. Where can they find you?
Well, the website has everything. So nextdoorsmusic.com is a good place to start. But as for our music, you can find it wherever you listen to your music, whether it's Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, Bandcamp. You'll find us there, the Next Doors, including Swing and a Miss. Yeah, it's available everywhere, as we say. But please do visit the website, and then you can read more about what we do and some articles that have been written and upcoming shows and all that good stuff.
I always try to tell people, please do go to Bandcamp if you can, because if you spend money on Bandcamp, the artist gets a lot more of that money, almost all of it goes to the artist there, where Spotify, Apple Music, as great as they are for getting the word out, money doesn't filter down to the artists, and it is important to make sure that Russell and other artists who are putting their heart and souls into these songs do get paid. So
yeah, so just, you know, even if you just consider Bandcamp essentially a tip for, like, even if you don't, like, I just have an iPhone, I don't download music onto it, it's just not what I, that's okay, you can still buy the album and then don't click on the link to download, and you've tipped the artist a little something, and then listen on Spotify. It's a nice thing to do.
Absolutely. There we go. Yeah. Go listen to Swing and a Miss, folks. It really is a great song. I think you'll enjoy it. And go support the Next Doors.
Thanks, Kevin.